an almost impossible chore for anyone without first-hand knowledge of the situation. A reporter trying to find out the facts would now have to choose between two conflicting sets. He could not know that one of the sets, the one bearing the imprimatur of an advisor to presidents and president of the Association of the Bar of the City of New York, was false. And reporters were not trying to find out the facts. Their publishers and the editors who carried out the publishers' wishes made sure of that. If one reason the city did not get to see the true picture of what was going on the Title I sites was Moses' strategy, another, more important reason was that the press was not trying to see behind that strategy. Mrs. Gable feels that the draft relocation report she helped write, the draft that ended up as the Planning Commission's minority report, was a significant document in the history of urban renewal in New York City because it was the first major relocation exposé, the first public report, the first official report by any governmental agency that even hinted obliquely that Moses wasn't God. But Mrs. Gable was wrong. The facts presented in the minority report and their implications for the future of the city were as significant as she felt. But the report's impact on the city was not. It was an exposé without exposure. The public at large hardly knew about it, because it was hardly told about it. Although reporters, told by Orton that Moses' telephone tax proposal was a strictly diversionary tactic, had his statement confirmed by Bennett's confession when they questioned him closely that details had not yet been worked out. They never would be, either. The Times, Herald Tribune, and Daily News all led with this proposal. The Times did not even bother to mention the relocation controversy until the seventh paragraph, and then quoted, at greater length than it devoted to any other quote in the report, a reply to the minority report inserted in the report by Moses that implied, falsely, that the real purpose behind their report was to move about 20% of the entire city population, and said, no wonder the radicals would like to get hold of tenant relocation. The first that the radicals knew of Moses' reply was when they read about it in the newspapers the next day. Bennett, they charged, had locked up all the commissioner's copies of the report so that they couldn't get to see it, and hence couldn't answer it. Of the city's daily newspapers, only the Post devoted any substantial space to the relocation facts so laboriously uncovered. The reformers had provided the city's press with facts that disproved the statements by Moses and other city officials from the mayor on down that the press had been printing for months. If the city's press was unable or unwilling to obtain for itself ammunition to shoot holes in the curtain of secrecy surrounding the relocation of tenants on the vast Title I sites, it no longer had to do so. The ammunition had been stacked up, ready for its use by others. But the press did not use it. The fate of poor people had never been news in New York City. It still was not news. Housing had always been a field whose complications discouraged the press from delving beneath its surface. Thanks to Moses' strategy, moreover, the official report, the report the press was almost obligated to carry, now said that there was nothing wrong, or even worth discussing, with the relocation program. There seemed no reason to delve beneath the surface. The suspicions of the press, which would normally have been aroused by the rumors of deals and involvement by high-level politicians in a program calling for a vast write-down by the taxpayers, were lulled by the fact that this program was being run by apolitical Robert Moses, his legend draped over Title I a comforting concealing cloak. The relocation report was never, except in passing, to be referred to in print again. Title I coverage continued to be predominantly a reprinting of Moses' statements and of facts from his brochures. As for city policy, just 1 week after the report's release, Hortense Gable appeared before the Board of Estimate as a representative of 17 civic groups protesting Moses' plans for his Washington Square Southeast Title I project. She appealed to the board not to approve the project until it had at least studied the report. Sheer, unadulterated bunk, Moses said. The board approved the project. On October 1, 1954, an event occurred that should, by all normal standards of newsworthiness, have been eminently newsworthy. For months, investigators of the Banking and Currency Committee of the United States Senate had been looking into Manhattantown's books, and, despite the frantic juggling which those books had undergone, had been able to come up with a detailed picture of the reliable bidder's financial operations. And on October 1st, in a public hearing held in New York, it placed that picture on public exhibition. The hearing was marked by remarkable lapses of memory on the part of Manhattantown's ostensible founder, Samuel Caspert, a Democratic clubhouse figure to whom Moses had seen fit to hand over, on behalf of the city of New York, 338 apartment houses and tenements housing thousands of human beings. Under questioning by Committee General Counsel William Simon, Caspert was unable to recall even whether there had ever been a written document, any kind of prospectus, formal or informal, telling prospective stockholders the financial details of the project in which they were investing. And whenever it seemed that Simon had Caspert firmly on the hook at last, there were deft interventions to get him off, by his counsel, Judge Samuel I. Rosenman. Interventions that were made easier by the deference with which Simon treated this prestigious public figure. But despite the evasions, denials, and interventions, by the time Senator Prescott Bush, a Republican from Connecticut, gaveled the hearing to a close late in the afternoon, it was a matter of public record, because it was a record of an official Senate committee hearing, privileged public record, so that any newspaper could print it without worrying about the possibility of libel damages, that more than 2 years before, the mayor's slum clearance committee had handed over to Caspert and Company 6 square blocks of Manhattan real estate worth $15 million for $1 million. It was a matter of public record that as of October 1954, the month of the hearing, Caspert and Company were required to have all 338 buildings demolished, but that about 280 buildings were still standing, their tenants still paying rents. It was a matter of public record that not one brick had been laid for any new buildings, and that not one piece of financing for new construction had been obtained. It was a matter of public record that, in the more than 2 years since Moses' committee had turned over the slum clearance project to his reliable bidder, that bidder's major activity had been not to clear those slums, but to milk them. And so were the replies of Simon and Senator Bush, made near the end of the hearing when the transcript indicates that they had come to the conclusion that Rosenman had pushed them around enough, when, after Simon had hinted that perhaps that was all Caspert and Company had ever intended to do, that the developers of the slum clearance project were trying to clear those slums as slowly as possible so as to continue making money from them as long as possible, Rosenman denied there was any intention not to go ahead with this project. Mr. Simon, the contract required that the new buildings be completed in 4 years, and more than 2 years have gone by, and only 1/6 of the demolition has been done, and none of the new construction has been done, which is a fact that speaks for itself. Senator Bush, the thing the committee is curious about, Judge, is whether the attractiveness of the operation that these people have been engaged in hasn't perhaps delayed the construction of these buildings, which is what the federal government is interested in. And although Rosenman replied to those statements by protesting that there is no such attractiveness, it is far from attractive, the truth of the judge's protests was also a matter of public record, a record based on Simon's questions, the evasions of Caspert and his partners, and the stark facts entered into that record by committee investigators. That record showed that the profits made off the hapless human beings in the buildings still standing on the Manhattantown site were so huge that Manhattantown's 13 stockholders had been able to receive from the company, in addition to regular partners' drawings, special payments made under a variety of devices apparently designed to conceal the attractiveness from investigators. One partner, for example, receiving through a construction company that had no office of its own and only two employees, himself and his secretary, $42,000, although no construction had been done, and through a management company, another $38,000. Another partner, for example, receiving $26,000 in legal fees. Another partner receiving $48,000 for accounting and auditing work. A group of partners receiving profits of $153,000 paid to a dummy management firm they had set up. As Simon put it, different people got cut in for a piece of different things, but when it was all over, everybody got a ride on one of the horses. And the record also showed that the profits the partners had already reaped, large as they were small compared to the profits the partners were planning to reap in the future. One partner, a close friend of Moses' ally, Bronx boss Charlie Buckley, was in line for $375,000 for architectural services. So huge were Manhattan Town's profits that they had been spread around among stockholders' fathers, stockholders' sons, stockholders' daughters, as well as stockholders' uncles, aunts, nieces, nephews, and assorted in-laws, and spread around liberally. The brother of the stockholder who had received $42,000 for construction and $38,000 for management himself received $30,000 as Manhattan Town's comptroller. In one transaction, just one of the many spread on the record by the committee to demonstrate how money was siphoned off from the parent corporation into the pockets of its partners and their relatives, Caspert had skimmed off for himself and his family $115,000 in less than a year. He set up a separate corporation headed by his son-in-law. Manhattan Town sold the son-in-law's corporation all the gas stoves and refrigerators in the tenements for $33,000, and then rented them right back from the corporation, paying it, in effect, for the privilege of using what had been its own appliances. And Manhattan Town paid so well, paid rental fees so high, that in less than a year, the son-in-law's corporation earned, after all expenses, $115,326.37. At the end of the year, Manhattan Town bought back the stoves and refrigerators for the same amount it had sold them, $33,000. Financially, Manhattan Town had wound up right where it had started, but the son-in-law's firm had pocketed $115,326.37. By the end of the hearing, it was a matter of public record not only that in more than 2 years the slum clearance project had cleared hardly any slums, not only that no progress was being made in providing the new housing that the project was designed to provide, but that everyone involved in the project was getting rich. Here, by any customary newspaper definition, was scandal. A major city administration program in which, it was now revealed, a $15 million slum had been turned over for a mere fraction of its worth to promoters who were milking it of hundreds of thousands of dollars, profits documented down to the dollar by federal probers. Here was scandal of the first magnitude in a town in which allegations of $20 bribes to a few building inspectors were found worthy of big black headlines. Moreover, juicy as had been the revelations of the Senate hearing, the hearing held the promise of far juicier revelations to be uncovered. There was the clear scent of far bigger scandal in the air. Manhattan Town was one Title I project. There were 10 others then underway in the city. One of them, in fact, also run by Samuel Caspert and friends. To reap that harvest of headlines, newspapers would normally have sent into the fertile fields of Title I their best gleaners, their ace investigative reporters. By customary practice, moreover, New York's papers would have brought into the picture an element the Senate hearing had not, the name of the city official responsible for the turning over of the slum to the promoters, the chairman of New York's Slum Clearance Committee. Rosenman let slip the name of that official only once, in the hearing's fifth and last hour, when he could not avoid using it in identifying for the record a report addressed to that official. In all the 66 pages of the hearing transcript, that is the only time his name appears. In referring to the authorities responsible for turning over the slum to Manhattan Town, it was always the city. The city's press would customarily not have been so vague. They would have identified the official, printed his name in big black headlines, used his photograph, questioned him, examined his answers to their questions with printed suspicion. By the time a normal press investigation of Title I had been completed, his name would have appeared in 100 headlines, his picture would have stared from 100 front pages. The public would have been reminded 100 times that he was the man responsible for Title I. In the public mind, his name would have been ineradicably linked with its failures, its abuses, and with scandal, the noun which had spelled the doom of so many officials' careers. But the Manhattan Town revelations hardly touched Robert Moses at all. The fear and awe in which he was held by reporters, rewrite men, copy editors, and city editors was never more evident than on the day following the Senate hearing on Manhattan Town and in the days that followed. Robert Moses had conceived the Manhattan Town project. He had directed its planning. He had selected the cast of characters who ran it. He had shifted the cast around when the political winds in the city shifted. It was a Robert Moses project from beginning to end. The Times story on Manhattan Town did not mention Robert Moses once. The other papers followed suit. His name was hardly mentioned. No editorials called for his removal. There might have been a scandal in Manhattan Town, but Manhattan Town's creator was unscathed by it. And because he was, Manhattan Town and the Title I program of which Manhattan Town was a part were largely unscathed, too. The Times did not do another story on Manhattan Town in the months that followed, but that might have been expected. The Times was not a paper of inquiry, and inquiry would have been necessary for follow-up stories. But what was not to be expected, from the customary behavior of the press in New York, was that no other papers would undertake any inquiry either. Not one investigative reporter was assigned to probe further into Manhattan Town or Title I. Some reporters wanted to, but were refused permission, in some cases probably because of their publisher's admiration for Moses, in most cases simply because it seemed to editors a waste of time. Where Moses was involved, they felt, there would be no scandal to be found. Trying to find it would be a misuse of manpower that could be more profitably employed investigating politicians or bureaucrats. The creators of the Moses myth believed in what they had created. The myth still glowed, as strong as ever, with a glow that blinded New York to the shabby reality of what was going on the Title I sites. During the following 18 months, the rest of 1954 and all of 1955 and the spring of 1956, there were, as there had been since 1952, continual rumors about Title I, continual protests about individual Title I projects, continual questions about the whole shape and scope and direction of Title I, and about the individuals to whom Moses had handed over so much of this program that was going to reshape the city. More and more people and groups were hearing these rumors, making these protests, asking these questions. The Women's City Club made a new follow-up survey of relocation practices at Manhattan Town, and other investigations were made by at least five other public and civic agencies: the 108-year-old Community Service Society, the one-year-old Citywide Committee on Relocation Problems, the Mayor's Committee on Housing, the City Administrator's Office, and Walter Fried's Federal Housing and Home Finance Agency. The results of all received only cursory treatment from the press. By the end of 1955, Stanley Isaacs was being joined in his repeated pleas for an investigation of Title I by several maverick city councilmen. All of those pleas were buried in council committee and in the newspapers. The myth that shielded Title I and other Moses public work projects 1953 and 1954 were, after all, the years in which he was ousting from their homes the 1,530 families of East Tremont who could find a voice for their cries only in the New York Post, from public view, stayed firmly in place. The movement to reveal the truth about Moses' projects had been an underground movement, a movement led not by the City Planning Commission's majority, but by the rebel Commissioner Orton and his 15th-story undercover band of researchers, not by the city's reform housing establishment, but by the new, boat-rocking Hortense Gable. As late as April 1956, it was still an underground movement. "We were still voices crying in the wilderness," Orton recalls. "We couldn't get anyone to listen to us." A World Telegram and Sun reporter managed to write a two-part series on relocation, a pallid surface description that left the impression that all was generally well, without mentioning, even once, the man most responsible for relocation. Before the city could begin to see the truth about Moses' programs, his legend would have to be exposed for the lie it was. Before the people would be willing to look at Moses' programs straight on, they would have to look at Moses straight on. And before the public could do that, there would have to be an issue that would show him so clearly for what he was that there could be no mistake. Chapter 42. Tavern in the Town. That issue might never have arisen if some engineer hadn't left his blueprints lying around during lunch hour. He left them in a little glen in Central Park, a grassy, tree-shaded hollow between 67th and 68th Streets, about 300 feet in from the stone wall along Central Park West that Frederick Law Olmsted had built to mark the line where the city would end and serenity begin, where, among country roads and scenery, the city dweller could forget for a time the rattle of the pavements and the glare of brick walls. Robert Moses had made forgetting more difficult. Before 1934, the Glen, shielded from Central Park West to the west by higher ground, had faced, across Bridle Path and West Drive, kept curved and narrow by Olmsted to discourage auto traffic and shielded from the Glen by heavy shrubbery, Jacob Ray Mould's classic little sheepfold, and beyond it, the broad green or sheep meadow, on which the woolly white South Downs grazed placidly under the eye of sheepdog and crook-carrying shepherd. After 1934, the new park commissioner threw out sheep and sheepdog and shepherd, converted the sheepfold into the Tavern on the Green, built a parking lot behind it, and, to provide more convenient access to the restaurant, cut a new road, an extension of 67th Street, into the park past its front door, where he widened the pavement into a large parking circle. Thereafter, the view to the south from the Glen was asphalt and automobiles. He straightened and widened the West Drive, decimating the shrubbery shield in the process, and thereafter the herds to the east were not meandering sheep, but thundering cars. On the high ground to the west, there were now swings and slides, and asphalt and a tall black iron fence, one of the perimeter playgrounds the park commissioner had built to intercept children who wanted to use the park. Yet, within its sheltering border of trees and bushes, behind its shield of high ground, the Glen still offered at least a measure of refuge from the city, particularly for mothers with small children. Its big trees, huge boulders, and expanses of grass made it a perfect place for kids to play. On a typical day, the Glen was a picture, an urban version of a pastoral landscape, of kids throwing baseballs or footballs, kids scrambling up boulders, kids climbing trees or lying behind them in coonskin caps. 1956 was television's Davy Crockett era, bang-banging their six-shooters or Texas long rifles at each other, or ambushing the automobiles heading past along the West Drive. And as the kids played, their mothers sat chatting on a row of benches situated between Glen and playground so that they could keep an eye on both at the same time, sat among trees and grass and quiet. "You know, at that time in your life centers around your children," says one. We lived in that little spot in the park. We took our kids twice a day. Once wasn't enough, for God's sake. I remember once being in that playground in the snow, freezing. That little spot in the park was really the center of our neighborhood, and it was beautiful, tranquil. You know, in a city like New York, a spot like that is really precious. Then, on April 9, 1956, a sunny spring Monday, one of the mothers, Roselle Davis, sitting on a bench watching her 4-year-old son Earl play in the playground, noticed below her in the glen a group of men with surveying equipment and blueprints. The sight didn't disturb her. "I thought they were planning some sort of improvement for the playground," she recalls. But walking home at lunchtime, she noticed that although the men had gone for lunch, the blueprints were still spread out on the grass. Out of curiosity, she bent down to read them, and saw their title, "Detail Map of Parking Lot." Returning to the playground after lunch, Mrs. Davis related her discovery to other mothers, among them Augusta Newman, wife of Arnold Newman, a world-famous photographer who possessed a healthy sense of moral indignation. "I wasn't sure that anything could be done about it, and I sort of forgot about it," Mrs. Newman recalls. "But that evening we went to a party or something, and in the cab coming home, I said to my husband, 'You know, Roselle told me today that they're building a new parking lot for the Tavern on the Green in that spot in the park where the boys play.' And he, unlike me, said, 'They can't do that.'" Although it was after midnight, he telephoned Mrs. Davis for more details, and then telephoned 67th Street's most famous resident, the elderly novelist Fanny Hurst, to solicit her help in writing a petition. In addition to his eye for social injustice, Newman had one for public relations. He was aware that because 67th Street contained the literarily oriented residence hotel, the Hotel des Artistes, and a row of studio duplexes designed for artists, complete to 2-story windows letting in north light, it was the home of a quota of names from the artistic, literary, and show business world, high even for the West Side. Two of the most famous illustrators of the 30s, Floyd Davis and Gladys Rockmore, lived in No. 1 West 67th Street, along with oceanographer William Beebe. Roselle Davis and her husband, painter Stuart Davis, lived in No. 15, as did dancer Pearl Lang. Number 33 housed, in addition to the Newmans, newscaster Raymond Graham Swing, publisher Jason Epstein, photographer Philippe Halsman, sculptor George Lober, and illustrator Dean Cornwell. Ludwig Bemelmans lived in Number 39, the Yiddish actor Joseph Bulof and playwright Samuel Raffelson in Number 40, violinist William Kroll in Number 50. Around the corner on Central Park West lived composer Harold Rome. The hotel's residents included Howard Chandler Christie, who had painted the nude-filled murals in its Café des Artistes. He took the sun every morning on a park bench near the Glen, nodding politely to the mothers walking by. And Mae Murray, the merry widow herself, the woman who had once been Hollywood's most glamorous star, lived in the hotel in an attic formerly a chambermaid's room. When the petition was written, Newman got a healthy number of high-caliber names on it and then sent his wife and Mrs. Davis out soliciting signatures from mothers at the playground. Trying to telephone the park commissioner, he received a customary Moses brush-off, but he mailed him the petition, signed with 23 names, with a copy to Mayor Wagner. The newly appointed deputy mayor, educator John J. Theobald, just recently recruited from his Queens College presidency by Wagner, to whom the mayor referred the matter, did nothing about it on Wednesday, and gave no indication that he was contemplating doing anything about it ever. But another one of the mothers happened to be the wife of a Herald Tribune reporter, Richard C. Wald. By Thursday, Wald had realized that the story he had been told by his wife might be of interest to a wider audience, and even though Stuart Constable, the pompous Park Department executive officer whose bushy walrus soup strainer had earned him the nickname Mustache, tried to make him understand that this parking lot he was making such a fuss about would be less than an acre, a meaningless fraction of 1% of 843-acre Central Park, it was printed in Friday morning's edition. By 11 o'clock, Theobald had decided that the thing to do was to hold a meeting between representatives of the mothers and of Moses that afternoon, and, unable to reach Moses, asked one of the commissioner's secretaries to have him call back and tell him what time would be convenient for him or one of his top people. Local protest over a park improvement may have been a new story to Theobald, but it was an old one to Moses, old and boring. Ever since he had become park commissioner, he had kept such protests to a minimum by keeping the improvements secret, so that often, before the neighborhood concerned knew there was an improvement planned, it was already underway, and by ignoring protest and going ahead with the improvement as if it didn't exist. Scores, hundreds of mothers' committees and chambers of commerce and civic associations and taxpayers' associations and merchants' associations and block associations had objected to one plan or another for a parking field or a baseball diamond or a playground or a highway in some city park, and Moses' method had almost invariably proven effective. Not a week before, in fact, Flushing mothers had begged him not to destroy the only spot of green anywhere near their neighborhood by cutting down about 40 fine old trees to turn Little Weeping Beach Park just south of Northern Boulevard into a paved playground. He had simply ignored the plea. The trees were down now and the paving machines complacently at work. On the seismograph on which Moses recorded public tremors, in fact, the Tavern on the Green protest had barely registered. 23 mothers? He had just finished evicting hundreds of mothers rather than shift a section of his Cross Bronx Expressway a single block. He was at that very moment in the process of displacing 5,000 mothers for Manhattan Town, 4,000 for Lincoln Center. A parking lot, and a tiny parking lot at that. He had just finished building a coliseum. The only aspect of a protest that concerned him at all was the play it might receive in the press, and there seemed no reason for concern on that score. The city's big dailies seldom gave more than token coverage to local protest anyway. Not one had carried so much as a line on Weeping Beach Park. His rapport with the press, the Post accepted, of course, was at one of its all-time peaks now that the Coliseum Title I project, in which publishers were so interested, was completed. The editorial board of the one paper that had printed the story on the Tavern on the Green protest was that very morning deciding to run the next day an editorial lauding the Coliseum as stimulating evidence of his tremendous progress in Title I. Most of the dailies were preparing to take the occasion of the Coliseum's formal opening in 2 weeks to heap encomiums on its creator. The Times, in fact, was going to publish a special 72-page New York Coliseum City magazine section on opening day, with Moses commissioned to write an article on what the city means. Writers of letters to the editor might be more and more critical, but as for editorial writers, the writers who counted, after 30 years of lionization by their pens, he was still their lion. Just a month before, two key ones had taken time out from their ordinary duties to review his just-finished Working for the People, and, perhaps because of the difficulty of finding favorable things to say about that non-book, had devoted most of their reviews to its author, the Tribs' L.L. Engelking calling him the selfless servant of the people, William Ogden of the Times calling him one of the greatest public servants of our time. The only element of the protest worth noting at all was that Theobald had dared to suggest that it be given a hearing. This refugee from the campus needed a lesson. Not Moses, but one of Moses' secretaries returned Theobald's call by reading him a memo from her boss. Picking up his telephone, expecting to find Moses on the other end, the startled deputy mayor heard a woman's voice saying, "We are not prepared to attend any conference. I do not think the deputy mayor should get into matters of this kind, which are the concern of commissioners, until the commissioners have answered letters." The mothers would be answered next Tuesday. Until then, let them wait. "We would suggest to Dr. Theobald that he not see these people until after we have answered their letter." Even as Moses' secretary was reading his memo promising an answer, moreover, Moses was issuing an order that would make the answer, and the protest, meaningless. Early Tuesday morning, before the mothers would have received their mail, a bulldozer was to tear up the glen. His letter would not placate the mothers, of course, but that would no longer matter. By the time they read his explanation of why it was necessary to destroy the glen they were fighting for, there would no longer be any point in fighting for it. It wouldn't be there. This protest would be disposed of as he had been disposing of protests for 30 years. But this protest was different. It was different partly because the protesters were well-educated and healed, possessed of both the sophistication to know the best methods of fighting Moses and the money to implement those methods. There hadn't been a single lawyer among the 1,530 East Tremont families in the path of the Cross Bronx Expressway near Crotona Park, but there were plenty of lawyers, good ones, among the 100 or so families near Central Park West and 67th Street whose children played in the Little Glen, and many of them were willing to take the case for nothing. And those families could afford to raise the money for the substantial other legal expenses for a full-scale fight against the city. This protest was different because the issue behind it was unusually clear-cut. Protests on housing invariably involved arguments based on differing and involved philosophies to which there were always 2, and often 20, sides. Protests on highways were complicated by a myriad of arcane engineering considerations. Protests involving parks were generally simpler, but usually when Moses tore up part of a park for a non-park purpose, the purpose was clearly a public one, a highway, for example, so that the issue was complicated, and in presenting it, the press was also hampered by its necessary reliance on expert opinion, most of which was controlled by Moses. But there was nothing complicated about this issue. No expert opinion was necessary to decide the rights and wrongs of tearing up a park for a parking lot that would benefit only a private restaurant, an expensive restaurant at that. New York's press was enthusiastic only on clear-cut issues, and here was one that was very clear-cut. This protest was different because Moses' responsibility was unusually clear-cut. Because of the non-traditional role, a role outside the normal democratic processes that he played in Title I and highways, his responsibility was difficult for the public to understand, particularly because the press, which did not appear to fully grasp it either, never explained it adequately. But his responsibility here was clear and direct. No newspaper had to make the connection. But the primary difference in this protest had nothing to do with philosophy or governmental roles. It was due to the simple physical fact of the parking lot's location. The park in which it was located was Central Park. Central Park was something very special to New York. It was special because it sat, spacious and green and beautiful, at the very heart of the concrete city. Because more New Yorkers used it than any other park. Because it was practically the backyard for an astoundingly high proportion of the city's wealthiest and most influential individuals. Because for most of these users, and for hundreds of thousands of others, inhabitants of the otherwise all but greenless center of the most densely inhabited island in the world, it was their only park. It was special to New Yorkers interested in park history because of its beauty and historic significance as the first and most influential of American landscaped parks. It seemed little less than a miracle to them that in this greediest of cities, 843 acres of the most valuable real estate had somehow been set aside and preserved for 100 years as a public resource. It was special also because journalists had made it special. For 100 years, newspapers had paid more attention to Central Park than to all the city's 710 other parks, large and small, combined. Central Park had, like a president, become news in itself. Central Park had become a symbol that evoked universal and positive emotions in New Yorkers. It had become the symbol of beauty, open space, peace, fun, of everything parks meant to a city. Of all the city's wonders, the city's historians said, Central Park ranks first in the affection of New Yorkers. If all parks were holy to New Yorkers, Central Park was the holy of holies, a thing that must be preserved. Every attempted invasion of Central Park for a non-park purpose, no matter how small, was a cause to which an editorial writer's response was almost Pavlovian. In the 100 years since its creation, 1,000 editorials had proclaimed that every foot of it was sacred. Even during the 1930s, when it had been all adulation for Moses in the press, protests over Moses' remaking of parts of Central Park had been treated with seriousness. That they hadn't been more serious was due to Moses' success, because of his ability to use great forces of WPA workers without going through normal city governmental channels in rushing through his remaking in secrecy, to the fact that Tammany-induced decay in the park had reached a point at which any change could hardly help being an improvement, to the fact that his baseball diamonds and playgrounds were, after all, park purposes, even if not the purpose for which Central Park had been intended. But these conditions no longer existed. There was no WPA and no Tammany, and not even Robert Moses could make the city believe that the Tavern on the Green parking lot was a park purpose. Moses' reputation as a defender of parks, the keystone of his whole image, had endured because what he was doing to parks, like paving over the beautiful Van Cortlandt Park marshes for the Major Deegan Expressway, had been carried out largely in secrecy because the press had never focused public attention on it. Only a year or so earlier, a group of Sutton Place mothers, every bit as well-educated and quite a bit richer than the Central Park West mothers, had been unable to get any publicity for a baby carriage picket line they threw up to protest his rape of their East River Drive playground at 49th Street. But there could be no secrecy about anything he did in Central Park, a half acre of which meant more to the city's press than 150 acres of Van Cortlandt. Moses' image as park defender was still intact only because the public had never been given a close look at his park controversies. But at any substantial controversy in Central Park, the press would give the people a very close look indeed. And there was going to be a very substantial controversy in Central Park. In April, the leaves over the little glen were still only a pale green haze, not yet thick enough to obscure the view of the ground from Elliot and Eleanor Sanger's 12th-floor apartment directly across from the glen at 75 Central Park West. And when, at about 7 o'clock Tuesday morning, April 17, 1956, Eleanor Sanger awoke and went into the bathroom and glanced out her large bathroom window, she saw a large bulldozer ripping at the ground to tear out the roots of the trees. The Sangers were friendly with Stanley Isaacs, so Mrs. Sanger did what people who knew Stanley Isaacs always seemed to do when they were confronted with injustice. She called him for help. "Get the women out there, and call the newspapers and television," Isaac said. "I'll be right over." "What are you going to do?" Mrs. Sanger asked. "I don't know," said the dignified, white-haired attorney, then in his 70s. "But if I have to, I'll lie down in front of the bulldozer." As it turned out, he didn't have to. Mrs. Sanger telephoned Augusta Newman, who began frantically calling other mothers and telling them to call others. Within minutes, astonished doormen saw 30 or 40 women running down 67th Street and along Central Park West, yanking along dogs and little children and wheeling baby carriages. "The baby carriages were my idea," Augusta Newman says. "I thought they would make a good picture. After all, we are in the business, you know. And anyway, most of the mothers had to bring their children. They didn't have maids. Their husbands were going to work. Who were they going to leave them with?" Running into the glen, where the bulldozer was snorting and grinding away, they began somewhat hesitantly, leaving plenty of room between it and them, to move to a position that would later be somewhat loosely described as in front of it. The driver, an employee of a small private contractor to whom Moses had given the parking lot construction job, cut his engine. "He was a very nice man," Mrs. Newman recalls. "He told a policeman, who would just come running up to see what was going on, 'I'm not going to do a thing as long as those ladies are standing here.'" When Isaacs arrived, he saw, beneath the trees, the earth-moving machine stopped, its driver standing beside it, a line of mothers and baby carriages, and, moving up close to them, policeman, who, summoned by the first, had sped up in several patrol cars. It was a tableau that, complete to Isaac's presence, might have been lifted intact from a score of earlier Moses battles. But within a few minutes, a new element had been added to it, an element that had been conspicuously missing from the earlier tableaus, and that was to make April 17, 1956, the watershed of Moses' career. Following Isaac's instructions, Elliot Sanger had telephoned more than a score of newspapers, radio stations, and television stations to ask them to send men to the scene. And they did. 100 neighborhood representatives had asked radio stations, television stations, and the big citywide daily newspapers to cover their protests against Robert Moses' projects. If they were lucky, two or three sent a man. Often only the Post did. Often even the Post didn't bother. Lillian Edelstein had managed to get 3 mayoral candidates and an audience of 400 people to the rally at JHS 44 in East Tremont. In that audience, there had been not a single reporter or photographer. But on this Tuesday morning, there came, driving into the Tavern on the Green's parking circle, jumping out and running over to the Little Glen, shoving microphones and triple-folded copy paper into the faces of the mothers and the bulldozer driver, reporters and photographers from the Post, and from the Herald Tribune, the World Telegram and Sun, the Journal American, the Daily Mirror, from the Times, the newspaper with the greatest prestige in the country, and from the Daily News, the newspaper with the largest circulation in the world, even from the Brooklyn Eagle, from WMCA, WOR, WABC, WNBC, WHN, WINS, WNEW, from WCBS-TV, WNBC-TV, WABC-TV, WOR-TV, and WPIX-TV. 100 local protests against some plan or other of Robert Moses had been carried out, so far as the public was concerned, in secrecy. The secrecy so necessary to Moses' success. This local protest against this Robert Moses plan would be carried out in a spotlight, the brightest spotlight on earth, the spotlight thrown by the mass media of the city that was the communication center of the civilized world. Within hours, every major radio station in New York was telling its listeners the story of the mothers, the baby carriages, and the bulldozer. That evening, the story was on every major television newscast. The next day, a picture of mothers and children lined up defiantly between the menacing machine and a large tree was displayed prominently in every newspaper in town. By the weekend, with Moses trying to trick the protesters by taking no action on Wednesday, giving reporters the impression that he would await the results of a Thursday conference between Theobald and the mothers, and then ordering the bulldozer back into action Thursday morning, only to have it turned back again by sentries because the mothers had set up a rotating schedule that kept the Glen guarded from 7 a.m. to dark, trying vainly again on Friday with a new bulldozer operator bearing assurances that all he wanted to do was move some topsoil around, the story was on page one. It would stay there for weeks. For this story had everything. It had names. Lillian Edelstein couldn't get one quote in the news. The news begged Fannie Hurst for a quote. Central Park stands as a heartbeat of the asphalt city. Yet we see trees sacrificed to a restaurant and a nightclub. And it had more than names. It had trees, too, especially since the week in which Moses had chosen to cut down the ones in the Glen happened to be National Arbor Week. Said a front-page World Telegram box, "School children have been memorizing, 'Woodman, spare that tree, touch not a single bough.'" And up in Central Park, Park Commissioner Robert Moses observed the week in his own unique way by sending axe-wielding workmen to chop down a stand of maples to make way for a parking lot. And it had more than names and trees. It had Central Park. By the second week, several papers had found the catchphrase they were looking for, the Battle of Central Park. It had more than just names and trees in Central Park. It had bulldozers, a word that by the mid-1950s carried enough emotion-laden and unpleasant overtones to keep a story going all by itself. And it had more, much more. It had mothers. Parks and trees might be motherhood issues, but this was more than a motherhood issue. This was motherhood. The press saw this and made the most of it. It was Moms versus Moses in the news, and the Brigade of Mothers in the World Telegram, and Park Moms in the Post, and Fighting Park Moms in the Journal American, and the Embattled Mothers of Central Park in the Herald Tribune. As the headlines blasted out at New York 5 and 6 a day, day after day, the words that leaped from them, bold and black, were not only magic words like parks and trees and bulldozer, but the most magic word of all. And the stories under the headlines were stories about mothers engaged in that most holy of mothers' wars, a battle to protect a place for their children, their tots, their kiddies, to play. A mother's battle to keep the grassy, wooded section a haven for their children away from the concrete and clatter of the city streets, as the World Telegram put it. There was nothing unique or even unusual in the Battle of Central Park. But because the site of this battle was Central Park, the press had begun looking at it, and had seen elements so sensational that it couldn't, even if it wanted to, tear its fascinated eyes away. The tactics Moses was using were the tactics he had been using for 30 years. But now the press was reporting them, and a whole city was watching them. The things Stanley Isaacs was saying now were the same things he had been saying for 30 years. The only difference was that now people were listening to them. Now when he spoke, a dozen microphones were held up before his face, amplifying his words, as Moses had been amplified for 30 years, until they were loud enough for a whole city to hear them. This time, his tightly reasoned letters to the editor were quoted in editorials and in news articles, front-page news articles. When Moses replied with the argument he had been using against Isaacs ever since he had helped drive him out of his borough presidency with it in 1938, the Daily Mirror picked up the attack as usual. "The clack complaining about Robert Moses is headed by Stanley Isaacs, who, when he was president of the borough of Manhattan, gave employment to Simon Gerson, who was a communist." But for once, the first time, the Mirror's voice was a lone voice. For once, when Isaacs tried to explain to the press the philosophy behind Moses' projects and what was wrong with that philosophy, the press paid heed to the explanation. Even on the editorial page of the newspaper that had been Moses' staunchest defender for 30 years, and whose principal stockholder believed, "There has never been as great a public servant." Exactly what happened in the editorial conferences of the New York Times is not known, although certainly Mrs. Sulzberger's love for Central Park, the original concept of pastoral, serene Central Park, the love which she had previously subordinated to her admiration for Moses, had something to do with it. And possibly so, too, did the fact that by 1956, the brilliant conservationist John Oakes was taking a more active role on the editorial page. On April 20th, the Times carried an editorial that, while it perpetuated the Moses myth, also contained statements that were, coming from the Times, especially remarkable. As remarkable as the editorial's title, "Only a Half Acre, But..." If this land were somewhere else, there would be nothing to get excited about. But Central Park is different. To New Yorkers, and especially those who live near the park, it is sacred land. To use it for anything but park is like insulting the flag. After fighting all these years against all the causes that were offered to invade it, why should New York at this late date give up half an acre for the personal convenience of 80 carloads of people having chicken dinner in the tavern? Those who protest do so belatedly. We plead guilty, like the rest, to tardiness. This is regrettable. But the principle on which protest is based is no less valid, and ordinarily Mr. Moses would be its chief defender against those who would destroy a blade of park grass. Let the diners at the tavern ride there in taxicabs. Things had gone far enough. When the coordinator struck again, he struck with picked troops, not some contractor's hired hands, but uniformed Park Department veterans, men loyal to the Sycamore flag, and to the promise of overtime pay for the unusual mission on which he was dispatching them. And he sent them into the field under the personal command of an aide whose enthusiasm for such missions was a legend in the department, the hard-bitten commander whom other men called Mustache. He struck in secrecy, in after-midnight darkness, when the enemy's sentries had been withdrawn for the night. At 01:30 hours on April 24th, when only a few scattered lampposts and a three-quarter moon broke the gloom of the battlefield, Constable had prohibited the use of any other lights, a hand-picked Park Department platoon, headed by a gardener first class, moved into the glen, hammered steel stakes into the ground around its perimeter, and wired to them a snow fence of wooden slats about 4 feet high, strung on wires. It was not until the fence was in place, and painted to make it look all the more official, that the more easily spotted mechanized equipment was brought up, and then the bulldozer was moved into position inside the fence on a flatbed truck so that its noisy treads would not have to be activated until the moment it went into action. To ensure against leaks, not even the police department had been told what was going on. It was not until about 3 a.m. when a patrolman, summoned by a stroller on Central Park West who had heard a mysterious hammering coming from the park, arrived and saw, to his shock, shadowy figures moving about in the darkness, that a call was made by constable to police higher-ups, and then it was made to request the immediate dispatch of reinforcements in sufficient force to repel any counterattack, and of both sexes, so that newspaper photographers would not be able to take pictures of any mothers who had to be hauled away being hauled away by men. When, shortly before six, an early morning horseman came cantering along the bridle path, he suddenly saw, through a mist that shrouded what had always been an empty glen, a bulldozer, a truck, and a platoon of green-uniformed parkies inside a fence, and, in a ring around the fence, 31 policemen and policewomen under the command of an inspector and two captains. The sight so startled his horse that it reared and almost threw him. By the time daylight revealed the scene to the apartments above, and the first of the mothers came running into the park, the bulldozer had pushed over a big maple tree, and Park Department axemen were chopping it into small pieces. And when the mothers tried to reach the machine, the policemen joined hands and politely but firmly stopped them at the fence. These were not mothers to whom more violent protest would have been even a possibility. They did not even consider fighting the policemen. There was nothing they could do except stand outside the fence and cry as the trees came down. And the media went wild. "It was a dirty, lousy stab in the back," Mrs. Sanger said, and that was how the media played it. The Brigade of Mothers lost their battle at the Tavern on the Green in Central Park today after the city mounted a sneak attack under cover of darkness, said the lead in the World Telegram. Other papers painted the park commissioner as a bully as well as a sneak. The lead in the Post said sarcastically that he routed a small band of women and children. It was a brilliant victory. Rewrite men rose to what for them was almost poesy in describing the sylvan victims felled on the hillside on which he plans to build a beautiful asphalt-surfaced parking lot. "Sweet-smelling, sticky sap ran as the chips flew," mourned the World Telegram. On its editorial page, the Post raged. Who else but Bob Moses would have been audacious enough to proceed in this fashion before the issue could even be debated before the city council? Who other than Moses would have been capable of so arrogantly saying, "The public be damned," and added a prediction? Politicians live in awe of him, and journalists treat him with nervous reverence. But we think the man has finally overreached himself. Before this is over, at least a few more city dignitaries and editorial writers may finally say out loud that Robert Moses can be wrong. And the Post was right. For the first time, its outrage was echoed in other editorial voices. and the words didn't hurt nearly as much as the pictures. As the trees had begun tumbling before the bulldozer, a well-dressed elderly woman, the hair beneath her stylish little cloche white, had run up to the fence and the policeman and stood there crying, trying to wipe the tears from her face with a handkerchief balled up in her white-gloved hand. Beside her stood